You may wonder why it is that so few physicians are using this knowledge, if indeed it is in the medical journals. And perhaps we can go to Dr. Kelly M. West again of the University of Oklahoma Medical School and quote from an article he wrote, sort of an apology, sort of a confession of his own experience with a high-carbohydrate, low-fat diet. And this might be what you might find in thousands of other physicians' experience. It was called Diabetic Therapy, an Analysis of Failure, and it was in the internal medical publication called Annals of Internal Medicine. And here's what he said. He said, I was treating a diabetic with severe hypertension in 1949. He said the rice diet of Dr. Walter Kempner had three times as much carbohydrate in as the diet the diabetic was on, and yet he found that the increase of carbohydrates required no increase in insulin. He said, like many other physicians who had this experience, I was reluctant to either fully accept the implications or to follow up the findings adequately. Now, the reason for his confusion was from the time that insulin was first used in our country, the way a physician worked it out, they'd feed the diabetics a certain amount of carbohydrates, and then they give them a certain amount of insulin. And they consider one balanced the other, and so they had to hold that carbohydrates just right, because the idea was that insulin-taking diabetic didn't have any of their own insulin. And if you double the amount of carbohydrates, then you'd have to double the amount of insulin. Well, Dr. West was quite surprised when he tripled the carbohydrates and required no more insulin. He said, however, in 1960 again, I did study another severely diabetic patient, and after a suitable time, I doubled their carbohydrates. Again, there was no change in insulin requirement. In the process of preparing a publication of this discovery, I was surprised to find that very similar experiments had been done before 1935 by Hemsworth, with the same results. Over and over again, this phenomenon had been rediscovered and subsequently forgotten or disregarded. What a confession for a man to make, who is an international authority in diabetes, to say that he himself had discovered the idea that high-carbohydrate diets are better for diabetics than the conventional high-fat diet, and yet he sort of pushed it aside when he first discovered it, and now he's going to write it up and tell the world about it. He was embarrassed to find it was done in 1935. And yet he continues, yet most Western physicians, dietitians, and their patients still believe that limiting dietary carbohydrates is the main reason of diet therapy. But history has shown that it's extremely difficult for physicians, dietitians, and patients to give up the notion that carbohydrates are bad for people with too much sugar in their blood. Although as Dr. West has rediscovered the principle of returning most diabetics to normal, Dr. Anderson has confirmed it in his recently published studies. The American Diabetic Association finally, in December 79, made their first good commitment. It's going to take a little time before the rest of the country catches up, but you're far ahead, and that you know what to do right now. Cancer is a dreaded disease in our countries and other countries around the world because it seems to be so mysterious. And more than that, the consequence of cancer seem to be almost universally fatal. And the death, of course, in cancer is something that nobody wishes to experience. So that the investigation what causes cancer has been going at a rather furious pace for many years. The first concept was that viruses somehow cause cancer as a major source, because we know it happens in animals. But the United States National Cancer Institute has spent $50 or $100 million a year for 20 years and has never gotten a clue on the viral cause of cancer. And I believe that the research is going to find that if viruses indeed are responsible for any of human cancer, it's going to be so small to be of little consequence. Because now we realize that the major causes of cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, breast cancer, and even lung cancer, are dietary caused or dietary controlled. Of course, we know that the principal stimulus to lung cancer is cigarettes in 90% of the cases. So it is a different kind of investigation that National Cancer Institute is looking at now. Remember, they're the federal agency that gets $1 billion a year of your tax money to try and find out what to do with cancer. You might say that the trends that have been developing finally let themselves be known when last October, that is October 1979, Dr. Arthur Upton, who was director at that time of the National Cancer Institute, made a public statement. And what he said was, "Heretofore, when people ask us what diet to recommend to avoid cancer, we couldn't tell them. We didn't know enough to make a dietary recommendation. For all the years we've been in business, we haven't been able to make one dietary recommendation. However, now, October 79, we're making our first dietary recommendation." And it was interesting as to what Dr. Upton said. Because first of all, he said, "You've got to cut down eating so many polyunsaturated fats." Well, that was curious, because that's what the American Heart Association has been telling us to eat all these years. Why is the Dr. Upton says you've got to stop eating those polyunsaturates? Well, it's easy enough. Dr. Upton said that the polyunsaturated fats in animal studies have been shown to substantially increase colon or bowel cancer. Therefore, we can't recommend it. How about total fats? That's something else. Dr. Upton said you've got to cut down all fats from your diet because the evidence is so strong now that total fats are directly correlated to breast cancer and also prostate cancer. In countries where the highest amount of fat is consumed per person, you have the highest amount of breast cancer in the world. In countries on the lowest amount of fat in the world, you have the lowest amount of breast cancer in the world. It's just what we call a straight line relationship. And Dr. Upton closed by saying, "My recommendation is to increase your intake of whole grains, fruits, and vegetables." Well, that should sound familiar to you, because that's our recommendation. Considering this the very first recommendation for cancer, I think we have to look back at it and see the basis of Dr. Upton's recommendations. Well, first of all, as far as colon cancer is number two in our country, 50 or so thousand deaths a year, and the investigations in colon cancer gone back away. Dr. Dennis Burkitt of England has had some thoughts on it, and Dr. Ernst Winder, president of the American Health Foundation in New York, has done a lot of work on it, and I can put you up to date on what the current concepts are. On the normal high-fat diet that the average American eats, it takes a certain amount of bile to help digest that fat. In fact, the amount of bile that the average American makes to digest the amount of fat he eats is anywhere up to 10 times more bile than you require with the diet that I recommend. Well, this tremendous amount of bile sets up an environment in the intestinal tract, the large intestine, for a certain kind of bacteria to grow very well, the anaerobic bacteria, because these bile-eating bacteria actually love to live in this atmosphere. They take the bile and they eat it, and their excretion products, their bowel movement, is the breakdown products of bile. One of the breakdown products is called deoxycholic acid, which we know is carcinogenic or co-carcinogenic, and also a certain kind of hormone that is absorbed back into the blood and sort of stimulates the sex target organs. Now, on the high-fat diet that makes this environment possible in order to grow these bacteria, the tragedy is that only in those countries that are on high-fat diets do you find these kind of anaerobic bacteria. And only in these countries that have a high amount of anaerobic bacteria and that their breakdown products of bile called deoxycholic acid exist, you find bowel cancer. In fact, you don't find bowel cancer unless you have a high amount of this cancer-producing substance produced by the bacteria in your large intestine. Now, you may be curious as to how bacteria, these little one-cell animals, so tiny you can't see them without a microscope, can create this problem. It'd be easier to understand when you know how many bacteria you have in your last 4 feet of tubing, your large intestine. You have more bacteria in your last 4 feet of tubing than there are people in the world. There's 4 or 5 billion people in the world, but you have more bacteria than that. And they're all living very peacefully in your large intestine, enjoying your bile as it comes down, and living well off the fat of your land. They don't pay any rent. They do you nothing but a disservice if they're anaerobic bacteria. In fact, you have so much bacteria in your bowel that if you sample your bowel movement for 24 hours, 1/4 to 1/3 of the total weight of your bowel movement would be in your own bacteria. You produce so much bacteria that every single day, 1/4 to 1/3 of your bowel movement is in your own bacteria. They multiply tremendously fast. One of these little bacteria, because they multiply about every 20 minutes, in 8 hours can produce 2 million bacteria. So you can see where you have plenty of them to spare every day. Now, in addition to the problem of the deoxycholic acid, which incidentally, the good bacteria that you would have if you're on the low-fat diet, because on that diet, anaerobic bacteria are so small in the intestinal tract that they hardly count. The major bacteria on the low-fat diet is called aerobic bacteria. They live without oxygen, and they do not have the power to eat bile, so they can't make the carcinogenic byproduct, deoxycholic acid. So the big thought now in colon cancer is to go back to low-fat diets, and that's one thing that Dr. Upton would like to see us do. Now, years ago, probably 15 years ago, Dr. Jeremiah Stamler, who at that time was president of the Chicago Board of Health, did a study with about 900 men working for the People's Gas Company. And these were all smokers. And he was trying to see the relationships of the length of time they were smoking and the amount of cigarettes they were smoking to lung cancer. And it was very difficult for him to find a relationship because he found some men that smoked a long time with no lung cancer, men who smoked a much shorter time with considerable lung cancer, and couldn't figure out why there was no relationship. He tried other factors, like whether married or not, whether they were active or not, worked in the office or worked with the gas fumes and so on, and couldn't find a relationship until he took their blood levels. And then he found his first relationship. And he found out that there was a straight line relationship between their cholesterol level and their lung cancer rates. In fact, if their cholesterol level is less than 225 milligrams per cent, there were only 5 lung cancer cases per 1,000. If their cholesterol level was 250, there were 18 lung cancer cases per 1,000. If the cholesterol level was 275 or more, there were 37 lung cancer deaths per 1,000. Cholesterol 275 or more, 37 deaths, compared to cholesterol 225 or less, only 5 deaths, 37 to 5, based on cholesterol level. In those days, we couldn't understand at all what does cholesterol level have to do with lung cancer. But we've learned since what the relationships are. And in the studies that many of scientists have made, like Dr. Carroll of Canada, so on, and his little animals, he finds if you take an animal and feed him a diet of no cholesterol whatsoever, and you transplant a tumor on the animal, the tumor grows to a certain size. But if you add 1% cholesterol to the diet, the tumor grows much larger, 2% much larger, 3% much larger. In other words, you can almost determine the size of that cancerous tumor on that animal by the amount of cholesterol you feed the animal. I couldn't understand at all what the cholesterol has to do with the growth of that malignant tumor. Other scientists have tried to see what the relationship was. In fact, one physician who reported his study in the New England Journal of Medicine reported 3 cases of prostate cancer, proven prostate cancer by biopsy in 3 men. And he arranged for them to lower their cholesterol level very considerably in a hurry. And in every case, the prostate cancer disappeared by biopsy. So it's proven that in 3 cases, we got rid of cancer by lowering cholesterol level considerably and rapidly. So cholesterol level obviously is rather important, and it was just a very short time ago when we discovered what cholesterol has to do with cancers generally. And the discovery was that high cholesterol levels paralyze the big white blood cell that eats cancer cells, the big macrophage. It makes it so it just cannot eat cancer cells or eat bacteria, eat viruses. And I think one of the best studies that illustrated this was just done a recently short time ago. And it was reported out in Nature, which is a scientific publication, in December 1978. And what they did was to take 2 groups of animals, and they gave them both identically the same diet. In fact, it was a synthetic diet, so there would be absolutely no difference from day to day. Natural foods vary somewhat in their composition, and so that you may say, well, the reasons the animals got better or worse, is because there was a variation in the vitamin content, in the carbohydrate content, in the fiber, and so on. But with synthetic diets, they're manufactured exactly the same every day. The diet they use is called Vivanex. Vivanex is a synthetic liquid drink, and the formula is 90% glucose, that's the carbohydrate. Glucose is a simple sugar that is the same as corn syrup, and 8.5% protein in the form of all synthetic amino acids. Remember that protein is made of amino acids. And then about 1% fat to give us the basic fat that the animals require and humans require, called linoleic acid. It also had whatever vitamins and minerals the body naturally needs. Now, this diet has been proven for a number of years. Children, for example, have been on this diet totally for 2.5 years, and yet on that diet they've grown 6 and 8 inches, so that we know that it contains all the things necessary for life. Well, these animals were put on Vivanex. Now, the difference was that one group of animals had their Vivanex spiked with cholesterol. They gave them the equivalent of cholesterol that a human would have if they ate 2 eggs a day, 600 milligrams of cholesterol. And so these little animals had that difference. One set, Vivanex plus cholesterol, the other, Vivanex without cholesterol. Now, all the animals were given a chemical through a stomach tube right into their stomachs that always creates bowel or colon cancer. Dimethylhydrazine, very potent chemical. After a year, let me tell you what happened. Of all the animals that were on the cholesterol part of the diet, 100% of them developed bowel or colon cancer. 90% already died of the colon cancer. 10% were still alive, but they were dying of the colon cancer. Well, that wiped out that population pretty well, but we expected it. We expected they would all die of colon cancer because that normally is what happens with hydrazine drugs. How about the other population without the cholesterol? That's a real surprise. 20% of them died within a year of colon cancer. The other 80% were alive and kicking with no signs of cancer whatsoever after a year. How is that possible? But what happened is that with no cholesterol at all in their food, their macrophages, their white blood cells, were so active that they're able to eat the cancer cells as soon as they were formed. And while the chemical is going through the body creating cancer cells, in 20% of the cases, the production of cancer cells was so great it overwhelmed the ability of the white blood cells to fight it, and they died. But in the other 80%, the white blood cells were able to eat more cancer cells than were able to damage the white blood cells. And when the chemical passed out of the body and no more cancer cells were formed, the body remained perfectly healthy. In fact, the investigators say this. They say that our observations corroborate the concept that specifically suggests that dietary cholesterol is a factor determining the rate of development of experimental colon cancer. If this applies to man, as the metabolic experience and evidence would suggest, then human colon cancer may be a preventable disease. Isn't that marvelous? If we limit the cholesterol, we can make your white blood cells much more active, and perhaps colon cancer then could be something only in history books. Now we understand something about Dr. Jeremiah Stamler's study with lung cancer. Because with the high rate of cholesterol level, that's where they had all their high rates of lung cancer. Now we understand that the high rate of cholesterol level paralyzed the ability of the white blood cell to eat the cancer cell formed by the cigarettes. Now, we're not telling you to have a low cholesterol level so you can smoke and not have lung cancer, because you'll get other problems. You'll have heart disease. Smoking's not good for any reason. But we certainly see the advantage of dropping your cholesterol. Now, Dr. Pauline tells us a lot about vitamin C helping cancer. Yet in his own laboratory, studies done by Dr. Arthur Robinson demonstrated this. With hairless mice, and he had about 900 hairless mice in this study. Now, hairless mice are convenient because if you give them ultraviolet treatment, radiation, they develop skin cancers. And the average on the average diet given to these little animals that have a little bit of cholesterol in, a little bit of fish meal, a little bit of liver meal, about 50 mice get 50 skin cancers. And when he gave them vitamin C in any quantity from zero up to probably 50,000 milligrams a day, equivalent to humans, in every case their skin cancers increased. And when he gave them vitamin C equivalent to what Dr. Pauline takes himself, 10,000 milligrams a day, the skin cancers doubled. Well, that was interesting. But when he gave them a different diet that had no cholesterol in whatsoever, instead of 50 cancers for 50 mice, it dropped down to 13 cancers for 50 mice, almost down to nothing. He didn't know at that time why dropping the cholesterol out would almost stop the cancer growth, but we understand now what does it. It permitted the white blood cells to eat the cancer cells and do the best for the body. I would say that the best cancer diet, prevention diet one could have, is to limit your cholesterol intake. Now the problem with cholesterol and with fat does other things too. Because in the case of breast cancer, the estrogen part of what these anaerobic bacteria do to you is just as damaging as the deoxycholic acid that comes out of their little bodies when they eat bile. Because the estrogen that comes out is absorbed back in the bloodstream and creates a real problem. Now, how important is it to worry about a little bit of extra estrogen that goes into the body? Let me tell you how sensitive the body is to estrogen not made by your own sex organs. A little 3.5-year-old girl was using some of her mother's estrogen-containing face cream. It was around the house, just smearing it all over her body, having great fun. And the mother thought that was sort of a babysitter and didn't pay much attention. 2 months after she started using this estrogen-containing face cream, the little girl's breasts started to grow. Well, that frightened the mother, brought her to a physician, examined the little girl, and found out that her uterus had the appearance equivalent to that of an adult female menstruating uterus at 3.5 years old. How is it possible that she could have developed that fast? Because when they tried to figure out how much estrogen was absorbed through this little girl's skin, it was so tiny they could hardly believe it. It didn't seem like it could mean anything. Estrogens are very potent when they're not made by the body to force the body's sex organs to grow. Well, how about the Planned Parenthood studies? Planned Parenthood has reported 100,000 women who, before they took oral contraceptives, and these are hormone estrogens that are used to control menstrual cycles for birth control, these women report as not having any cysts, cervical cysts in the uterus before they started. And yet in 6 months, 25% of them had cysts. In 2 years, 80% had cysts. And now we know that cysts are usually a pre-sign of malignancies, and so certainly they're not good to have. But that gives you an idea of the tremendous effect that these oral hormone estrogens have upon women. Well, how about Premarin? Premarin is that postmenopausal estrogen hormone that many women take after menopause. And the very large Kaiser studies have indicated to us that if you're on Premarin 1 or 2 years, there's a 400% greater incidence of uterine cancer, endometrial cancer. If you're on Premarin 7 years or more, there's a 1,400% greater increase of uterine cancer. 14 women will develop cancer in the uterus, endometrial cancer, compared to one who will not be on hormones. So we begin to see that its hormones could really be a problem when they're not made by the body. And that probably explains the earlier onset of menarche. Menarche is the first menstruation of a female. And it used to be that a female would grow up and become physically mature, 17, 18 years old, and then become sexually mature and have her first menstruation at 17, 18, 19 years old. Well, how is it that women today, children, are menstruating at 10, 11, 12 years old? How is it possible? Has heredity of man changed so that the whole menstrual cycle is way off that much? Well, this has only happened in the last 75, 100 years, when whole nations have decided to go on a high-fat diet, where before it was only for rich people and royalty. Well, with a high-fat diet, from the time you're a year old, you have anaerobic bacteria eating all the bile and making deoxycholic acid that eventually could create the colon cancer, and also creating the hormones, the sex-like hormones, that go back into the blood and force growth on the ovaries, breasts, and uterus. And that's why many authorities think that we now have a much earlier first menstruation because of this tremendous pressure of growth by the hormones from your own bacteria. And the pressure from your own bacteria of forcing these sex hormones into the blood, many physicians, investigators feel are primarily responsible for the breast cancer that we see. this tremendous pressure on growth by these hormones, sex hormones, from your own bacteria, create excess development of the breasts, ovaries, and uterus, and forcing rapid growth, which could be the precursor for breast cancer. Because we know that there are certain things we can test. For example, the prolactin level in the blood. That's the level that rises when a woman is pregnant and she is about to develop milk from the breast for the infant and so on. So that hormone put out by the pituitary gland rises. But we, after lactation, after breastfeeding and so on, it goes back to normal. In the populations where breast cancer is very low or almost unknown, prolactin level normally is reasonably low in women. In our country, it's always high in women. And if you take women in our country, and Dr. Ernst Winder has done this, and he's had a study with our own population here, where they come in on the first day and we take blood values, and we take it 4 weeks later. Dr. Winder has found if you take American women on the normal high-fat diet, and they have high prolactin levels, you put them on the low-fat, low-cholesterol diet, and in a very short time, the prolactin levels drop down to that of Japanese women. That is, since Japanese women only have 10% of the rate of breast cancer as U.S. women, in effect, you've dropped their breast cancer risk 90% by changing their diet. So we've got a lot of things to say about diet change in relation to cancer. Not only colon cancer, not only lung cancer, which we always thought was strictly caused by cigarettes, and now we see how important it is to drop cholesterol level, but also in breast cancer. And the tragedy of breast cancer, it might be reflected in the statement that Dr. Ernst Winder made before the Senate hearings on nutrition, when he said, in this country, if we could drop the fat and cholesterol in the diet down to levels such as our diet recommends, three principal cancers could disappear in this country: colon cancer, prostate cancer, and breast cancer. And breast cancer is the number one cause of death in women 35 to 55 years old. It's such a tragedy that we have to wait for these deaths and the suffering to happen before we make dietary changes. But we don't have to worry longer because we know now what to do, and there's nothing to stop us from making these changes, and we ought to do them today. The first 900 patients that came to the center were from about July of 1975 to September of 1977. And their results have been evaluated by the Loma Linda School of Public Health, their statistical survey department, Dr. David Abbey doing the direction. And some very interesting data has come out of that, and I'd like to give you some idea of what happens to people that come to our center in the four-week period that they're here. First of all, I should tell you that the diet that we use meets all the RDA specifications. That is, we meet all the federal specifications for protein, fats, carbohydrates, minerals, and vitamins, so that there is no question with the health authorities about the composition of our diet. But more than meeting just the specifications, what does it do for your health? Well, first I should say that the average person coming in, if there would be an average age, might be between 50 and 70 years old. So they're somewhere centered around the 60-year-old age. And the average person coming in, if we look at their diseases, two-thirds of them have what we call atherosclerotic heart disease. 50% of them have angina. Half of them have a stress treadmill test that's not good. About 28 or 9% have more than 20% over their desired weight, and that puts them into the obese class. About a third had a heart attack before they came. Out of the 900 people, 77 had coronary bypass surgery, and about 65 or 70 were recommended or scheduled to have coronary bypass surgery. Now, as far as cholesterol level is concerned, the average cholesterol level of the population was about 235 milligrams per cent. And when they left, their cholesterol level dropped to 175 as an average. Even the highest risk ones that were above 320 milligrams of cholesterol, whose average was 380 milligrams of cholesterol, dropped to 243 milligrams of cholesterol. In fact, I would think that about 90%, when they left the center, had cholesterol levels below 200 milligrams per cent. So that there has been a considerable change. The average change in just 3 weeks' time has been 26% drop in cholesterol level. Now, getting our major population under 200 milligrams, I think was very helpful because the Framingham study tells us that if cholesterol level is 260 or more, there's a 400% greater incidence in heart disease deaths or events than if your cholesterol is below 220. So 260 is a very bad number, and yet many physicians and health authorities consider that in the range of normal. So I'm happy to have about 90% of our people below 200, which I think takes them out of the high-risk area. Now, many people come in on drugs to lower their cholesterol level, and the principal drug that's used in our study is Atrmetes, or clofibrate. Clofibrate has now been somewhat discredited as a drug, but still it's being used quite a bit. I would estimate that probably 400,000 people are on Atrmetes in the country today. Now, Atrmetes can lower cholesterol probably 15-20%. And if you take people off Atrmetes, the cholesterol rebounds and jumps up 5-10-15%. So we had people come in with Atrmetes, and their average cholesterol level was 265 milligrams per cent. We took them off of the drug on day one, and I'm sure that it rebounded up, but yet when they left, their cholesterol was only 207. So we were able to drop their cholesterol level an average of 22% even after we took them off their medication. In fact, when they left, almost two-thirds had cholesterol levels less than 200 milligrams per cent. Now, as far as triglycerides, triglyceride is not considered the potent risk factor for heart disease as cholesterol is, but we certainly want to keep triglycerides down. Now, triglycerides, or that particular kind of fat in the blood, the average triglyceride was 174 milligrams per cent coming in, and when people left, it dropped down to 130 as an average. We had an average drop of about 25%. Now, the highest levels, people with triglycerides over 500, we had drops of 70%. So the diet is very effective in reducing high triglycerides. And yet, many health authorities have been of the opinion for years that high carbohydrate diets, such as ours, would raise triglycerides. And because of their articles and their lectures and so on, physicians have been frightened about the concept of a high carbohydrate diet. They all thought it was going to be a catastrophe for the patient, raising his triglycerides up to unacceptable levels. But that misunderstanding was because health professionals have not understood that there's a difference between carbohydrates, that simple carbohydrates like sugar, honey, and molasses indeed will raise triglycerides, but complex carbohydrates, food has grown that's been unrefined, like potatoes, beans and peas, whole grains and so on, lower triglycerides. And that has been their mistake. And that's why on our 80% carbohydrate diet, when we have triglycerides over 500, they drop 70% in just 3 weeks' time. So that I would say that when people left our center, 95% had levels below 170 milligrams per cent, which is the American high, when they left. Now, Atrmetes is quite effective at reducing cholesterol levels, perhaps 15 or 20%. But one thing it can do, and that is reduce triglycerides up to 40%. So it's a very effective triglyceride-lowering drug. And we had a number of participants that came in on Atrmetes with high triglyceride levels. Now, the average triglyceride of those coming in on Atrmetes was 201. And yet, when they left, their triglyceride level dropped 21% to 158. Now, you may wonder about that because when you take people off Atrmetes, triglycerides rebound and elevate. It's equivalent to some fraction of what dropped in the first place. So I think it's quite remarkable that we've been able to absorb that elevation and still have a drop almost equivalent to as if they had not been on the drug at all. For those on Atrumet S, about 85% had triglycerides less than 170 when they left our place. Now, we have measured the total number of fats in people's blood. We call it the total lipids. And people come with an average of 750 milligrams per cent of total lipids, and when they leave, they're about 564. What we mainly do is take most of them out of the high-risk range. How about gout? Elevation of uric acid is considered something that just practically can't be handled with a dietary approach. Most physicians feel there's no hope except for medical treatment, drug treatment. We disagree, and I think that the data certainly shows that. We had 37 people come in diagnosed with gout on medication. By the end of the 3 to 4 week period, 29 out of the 37 were off the medications with uric acid levels less than 7 milligrams per cent. 72% off their medications. Their uric acid is being controlled very nicely by the diet instead of the drug. Now, as far as other clinical risk factors, like smoking and weight and so on, we've done well with these. Our records seem to indicate that 86% were not smoking compared to those that came in that were smoking. Now, we don't have as yet follow-up figures to see how many continued not to smoke, but from our data, I would say that most of them are still not smoking, so that the once they've gotten off the smoking and stayed on the diet, they seem to stop smoking rather permanently. As far as weight reduction, for those who wanted to lose as much weight as they could, they lost an average of a half a pound a day, about 13 and a half pounds for the 26 days. Our present data is a little better than that. People that want to lose maximum weight have lost about 16 or 17 pounds on average in the 26 days. Now, hypertension is something I think that's been very neglected in considering nutrition as a therapy. Physicians, when they think about nutrition as a therapy for hypertension, they'll think about lowering salt, perhaps, or losing weight. But they don't think beyond that. They don't think there's any other importance beyond that. It's my impression that the amount of fat in the diet is at least as important as the amount of salt in the diet. And we're trying to study that further. But at least our results in hypertension, I think, are far better than any other nutritional therapy that's been reported in the medical literature. For example, we consider hypertensives those who have had at least a one-year history of hypertension and that were on antihypertensive medications on admission. And what we've done, instead of taking the blood pressures on the first day and the last day and comparing them, we've decided to be more conservative, and so our first initial, what we call baseline blood pressure, was an average of the second, third, and fourth, and fifth days. Many people by the third and fourth and fifth days lost their elevated blood pressure or off medication already, so that the results are not going to show up as dramatic as it would have been if they'd been on the first and last day. But taking the baseline as the second, third, fourth, and fifth day, and then the final blood pressure as the 22nd, 23rd, 24th day, we still had this record. Of all those that came in on blood pressure medication, and had been on blood pressure medication, many of them for up to 20 years, 85% were off their blood pressure medication with normal blood pressure. Now, that's a very high average. And when you consider that the recommendation for hypertensive patients is drug therapy on a daily basis for the rest of their life, you can see where there's a potential to getting millions of people off medication for the rest of their life and having normal blood pressures. We had 218 people coming in with blood pressure medication. 136 were off with normal blood pressures. Perhaps it might be easier to understand it if we go back to Dr. James Iacono's work. He was chief of human research at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Dr. Iacono did a study where he took normal men and women and put them on the typical American diet of 43% fat, 10 grams of salt, that's a third of an ounce of salt a day, and measured various parameters, checked their blood pressures closely and other things, and then only made one change. He dropped the fat from 43% fat to 25% fat. Kept the salt the same, kept the calories the same, he didn't want them to lose any weight. And within 10 days' time, everyone's blood pressure, both the top and bottom numbers, dropped 10%. Well, this was very good because a 10% drop could take abnormal people and make them normal. And one fascinating discovery he made was that the platelets, the little cells that control clotting, the platelets in the normal person are stuck together in fair quantities. And he found that the amount of platelet aggregation, or the amount of small platelets sticking together, decreased 50% after being 10 days on this lower fat diet. He kept them on this program for 40 days. Their blood pressure stayed down, the platelets stayed down low as far as sticking together, and then he brought them back up to their original fat diet. That was a 43%. Remember, all this time, no one gained or lost any weight. The salt was exactly the same, so that did not affect their blood pressure. And yet, after just changing the diet back to 43%, all their blood pressures elevated back to where they were. They gained 10%, and the platelets all stuck together just the way they were. So Dr. Iacono certainly demonstrated that fat in his diet was 25% fat. Ours is 8% fat. Perhaps that's why we're more effective than his was. But I think that his diet is a help to explain that we do have some confirmation in our concept that fat is a major constituent in the understanding of drop of blood pressure. As far as diabetics, we've been very successful with adult onset diabetics. And since adult onset diabetics comprise 90% of the diabetic population, they're an important group. And we found that of all the diabetics that came into us on insulin, adult onsets, 50% no longer required insulin within the 3 or 4 week period. If we look at their cholesterol levels, they were somewhat higher than the non-diabetic population, having an average of 277 milligrams percent cholesterol. Perhaps that's one indication as to why diabetics have so much more heart disease. The diet that they're on creates a much higher cholesterol level because they're recommended a rather high-fat, high-cholesterol diet to avoid carbohydrates. And that's reflected in the average non-diabetic had a cholesterol 235 and the average diabetic 277. Well, after the 26-day period, their average cholesterol level dropped to 191, a drop of almost one-third. And as far as triglycerides, the average triglyceride coming in was about 227, and that dropped to 158, another average of about one-third. So diabetics dropped their cholesterol and triglycerides about 50% more than non-diabetics on our dietary program. In fact, one diabetic had a triglyceride level of 2,770, and this man was on Atrimides. We took him off Atrimides, and yet he dropped his triglyceride down to 180 in just 3 weeks' time. So the high carbohydrate diet, as we have it, of natural foods, unrefined foods, is very effective in dropping triglyceride levels. Now, Dr. James Anderson, who's chief of endocrinology at the University of Kentucky Medical Center, has been using this dietary approach that we originally taught him 5 years ago, and he's been using it for his diabetics, and he's now published rather widely and documented the same results we have, that most adult onset diabetics no longer require insulin within a matter of a few weeks on this kind of diet. And we hope that this is going to convince health professionals that if you want to help degenerative diseases, these 900 former participants are a good demonstration of what can happen in just a 3 to 4 week period. Thank you.